This is Christine Blackburn, and I want to personally thank each and every one of you guys for listening to Storyworthy. Storyworthy has more listeners than ever before, and really, it's thanks to you guys. So please, tell a friend, a coworker, or a family member about the Storyworthy podcast, and then we can keep the shows coming. Now let's get to it.
This episode of Storyworthy is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You can register your domain name now for only $2.95.
Yeah, that's right. GoDaddy is offering OneNew or Transfer.com for the very low price of $2.95.
Yeah, whether you're starting a new business, you just want to put your idea online, or you just want people to look at you because you need attention, you can make a new.com or you can transfer a .com for only $2.95.
And when you're over there at GoDaddy, enter the code STORY295 in the promo code at checkout, and then you are in fact supporting this podcast.
You'll get what you want. We'll get what we want.
Say, bitch, this is Wally Rudolph, the Asian Violation, the TJ Maxx of fiction, Mr. UPS. What can Brown do for you? And you're listening to Storyworthy with Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney. Get your helmet. You're not ready. Go and get your helmet. You're not ready for this.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from Wolski's Tavern on North Pulaski Street in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And why are we here, Hannes?
Because this is the most famous tavern in all of Milwaukee. If you stay until closing time, which is late, you get an I Closed Wolski's bumper sticker,
which you see
all over the country.
Isn't that like the number one reason they'd pull you over then, right? I mean, this is like identifying yourself as having getting a DUI.
Not in California. This is Wisconsin. This is the Midwest. I Closed Wolski's is a badge of honor.
How do you spell Wolski's? I just want to know.
W-O-L-S-K-I.
It sounds like a place in Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh, we had a huge Polish, or there is a huge Polish population.
I know, and I'm trying to think of a dumb Polish joke. But because our topic today, speaking of drinking, is Drunken Master.
Drunken Master. And we have here with us author and actor Wally Rudolph. And he's got a story about Drunken Master, but I think he's coming at it from the angle of the kung fu movies.
Well, if you left Wolski's and had that drummer sticker, you'd probably be drunk enough. You'd go home and watch a kung fu movie and say, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. Mm. Get me more Leinenkugel and cheese curds, you would say, because you were in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, we've talked many times on Storyworthy about different times I've been drunk.
Yeah, see, we've never.
Stories.
Have you noticed that we have never talked about a time I've been drunk?
Yes, I know, because you're always in control, aren't you?
No. It's my fear of being out of control that causes me to never get drunk.
No, I understand.
Also,
I
don't particularly have. It's weird. It's like I have compulsions, and they are all about food. I don't know why I never had a compulsion to drink. It's
right.
Not. My dad used to go to the Tuxedo Bar all the time. By the way, you know it was classy because it was called the Tuxedo Bar.
Sure.
But I think maybe that was even just habit of like, oh, it's the 60s and you're in Milwaukee, you go to, you hang out at a bar.
Yeah.
It's like he didn't really drink either. He had other problems.
You know, it's true though, like growing up in Pittsburgh, it was like that in terms of drinking, because it was just like a way of life. So you would go to a Steeler game, a football game, and the game starts at 1 p.m. So you'd have to be tailgating by 10 a.m.
Sure.
And so you're drinking beer. You know, cans of beer specifically.
Of course.
And it's 10 a.m.
Iron City Light.
Drinking them. Icy Light, Iron City. And I remember thinking, this doesn't even taste good. And I'm going to have to get up and pee and miss the football game.
Yeah.
And I'm in a freaking parking lot.
Yeah. And it's 10 a.m. Why am I?
But I would. And I would drink it. And it makes me think to myself, like, why did I put myself through that? I don't understand. It's weird.
Yeah, no, it's just a social convention. It's like, why, you know, you don't have to, you don't have to, be a person who likes, like people in Wisconsin eat a lot of foods that are really bad for them. And part of that is just it's just social convention.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you don't really need sausage in the morning. Now, I'm not saying I'm not going to eat sausage in the morning.
Yeah, but I'm talking about alcohol as a recreational drug, and it is.
I'm talking about sausage as a recreational
drug. It is the most widespread recreational drug in the entire world.
Well, you know, smoking. Now that's gone. Used to be,
well,
you know,
not
those people.
Gone,
well, no, but it used to be the vast majority of Americans smoke.
Sure. I mean, and not only did they smoke, but they smoked in. I remember my father, the first time he got open heart surgery in 1985, I believe it was, his cardiologist walking out of his hospital room and smoking in the hallway. You know what I mean? The guy who just cut him open. Or is it the cardiologist who does that?
Yeah.
The surgeon. But it was a heart surgeon, and he's smoking cigarettes.
He's like, that was a tough one. I got to light up a Marlboro.
I mean, so smoking was very commonplace, but people didn't have the education that we have now about it, so I think it's clearly changed. But still, you know, I remember listening to This American Life and them doing this huge expose on Penn State campus and football games and the way kids are getting drunk. And that's the way we did it, too. It was just so stupid.
No, I know. Well, that's the thing. It's college especially, people are just incredibly stupid. Like, oh, well, I'm going to be socially accepted, so I will get – you know, it's one thing to get tipsy and it's one thing to get drunk. And then there's getting shit-faced to the point – where you literally have no control over your body.
Right, okay. And that is what's called alcohol intoxication, which is the consequence of alcohol entering the bloodstream faster than it can be metabolized by the liver. Which breaks down the ethanol into non-intoxicating
byproducts.
Means
your liver's a pussy.
No, for me, I think to myself, like, why didn't anybody, like, tell me that? Or did they tell me that?
They probably did.
But I feel like I'm going to make a chart for my daughter. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to get the whiteboard out, and I'm going to make this chart, and I'm going to say, you see how much blood you have? If you put more alcohol in than you have blood or a percentage, this is going to make you very ill.
See, but I think in the old days, they didn't necessarily think you had to be spoon-fed this information, because I didn't have to be spoon-fed this information, because I could see people literally going from an intelligent human being to a stupid pile of protoplasm. It's like you are I never looked at a person who was that drunk and thought that's good for them or that's not hurting them or I want to be like that.
Right.
I never ever thought that's good. It's like
it's bad. It's
they
bad
should have told
around.
You and yet should they have to tell you?
Right.
Should they really
right.
have
that
to?
Time my mother said to me something like, "Well, didn't you learn anything on your own or something to that effect?"
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, no, actually. I mean, I did. However, I think of the way I'm raising my daughter and the attention that she gets and the detail. Or I don't know, the amount I'm in her life. I mean, we're very
right, right.
Close.
And all of that, you know, information and about holes and stuff that you're always
that I had to tell her about. Yeah, but my point is, like, when I was growing up, my mother didn't tell me
anything. Right, right.
And so I didn't even know I had the three holes, like you're mentioning.
Which you mentioned over and over again. Yes, exactly.
I mean, it was just assumed that I would figure it out.
Right, right. I mean, as always, there's a happy medium where it's like you want to go, look, you know, you can't drink a 12-pack all by yourself because it'll kill you.
Now,
but then you have to admit, see, but I think people don't want to have that conversation with a young person because then they say, what if I drink five beers? And then you're forced to admit, if you're honest, you go, if you drink five beers, you'll be drunk. It's not going to kill you.
Right.
Then what the kid hears is, I can drink five beers.
Yeah.
Which is not what you're trying to say.
Right.
But on the other hand, isn't that better than not telling them anything? And they think, well, five beers, 12 beers, same thing.
I think that as a parent, you just give them the information as best you can, and then you be present as best you can. It's very hard. I'll tell you something, honest, because, you know, I don't have my daughter stays with her father a couple of days a week. And when I, you know, when she goes to his place, I feel such a loss of control because all of a sudden she's out of my, I mean, I know she's with the best person she could possibly
but
still. And so I already have this anxiety, this separation, not necessarily anxiety, but I'm learning that I got to separate.
Well, you have a thing about control. Period. No, you do. You have a thing about control, period.
See, Wally, this is what I this
I'm
is
not
what I'm
saying
going.
That
this
you
is
this
with.
Is not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just a fact. So what you have to understand for your own brain safety, okay, that really was not a control sentence I had to control of. For your own sake, It's like you will not be able to control. Even if she lived with you 7 days a week, you can't control everything she's thinking. She's not going to be with you 24 hours a day.
Right.
You just have to, you know, trust that she'll be smart enough that she'll make the right decisions. And isn't that the whole point of parenting? But here I have advice for you. If you don't want her to drink too much, you send her over to Uncle Hannes.
Mm-hmm.
You let me be the guy who tells her. See, she doesn't want to listen to you.
So we'll
your
do
mom.
Good
she doesn't
cop,
want to do
cop?
What?
Hmm? Good cop, bad cop?
Yeah. No, the sober cop or high cop and sober cop. That'll be me. You'll be your high cop. I'm sober cop. And it's like she, you know, I can tell her the bad news and it's not going to affect my relationship with her. She doesn't want to listen to you. She wants to listen to me. First of all, because I'm awesome. Second of all, because I'm not in the house all the time. You never want to listen to your parent who's right
listen,
there all the time.
I'm going to tell you right now, honest, I'm going to be honest with you right now. She wants to listen to you because she knows that you work at Universal Studios and she loves The Simpsons.
That's right.
And you get her Simpsons toys.
Right.
And she thinks you know the family.
Right. So I will tell her if you ever
no, but that's why
get,
she
go to a hospital
you.
For drinking, yes, that's fine with me. I'm
okay.
totally down
okay.
with that. Right. I will say that Homer Simpson will never come visit you.
Oh, my gosh. So you're going to threaten her.
I'm going to yes, exactly. This is called good parenting.
Listen.
Threaten the children with the with the fact that their favorite cartoon characters will hate them.
Listen,
I'll
guys,
tell her that Lisa Simpson never drinks.
We have
which is actually probably true.
By the way, she keeps calling Lisa.
Also, she's eight.
Yes. She keeps calling Lisa Simpson's saxophone a trumpet. I keep saying, Alabama, it's not a saxophone. Or it's not a trumpet. It's a saxophone. And then she goes right back to trumpet. What's going on?
Well, I think she's drinking already.
Ladies and
that's
gentlemen,
all I can think of.
We have a great storyteller here tonight. Now, this is interesting, Hannes. This guy is an author, and he just recently put out his debut novel called Four Corners. And boy, I'll tell you what, this is an amazing
Four
work
Corners,
of
not Five Corners.
No, Four Corners because it takes place in the Southwest where Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Nevada meet.
By the way.
But it is down and dirty and fascinated that he wrote this book, and we'll talk more about it.
By the way, the Four Corners, you know that's not in the right spot.
Oh, okay.
When you go to the when you go to the monument.
Right.
No, I'm serious. When you go to the like where it says here are the Four Corners.
Okay.
It's off by like a half a mile.
And how do you
because I just saw it on the news. They were like, here's an interesting fact. They
is
totally
that right?
put that in the wrong place.
Is that right?
Yeah. They were like, I don't know why the how they could get in the wrong place. I don't know. It was before GPS, I guess.
Wally Rudolph's dreams, right?
No, no, no. It exists. It's just that naturally the federal government put
the
monument.
Place.
They were like, it's close enough. It's
oh,
fine.
Oh, you're so funny. Anyway, so he's the one who brought forth the title Drunken Master. So he's got a story
yes.
about that. But before we get to our storyteller, I did want to remind you guys that if you'd like to support the Story Worthy podcast, that would help us quite
yes.
a bit.
You can go to storywithapodcast.com and click on the Amazon ad.
That's easy.
And then buy Wally's book. And then he gets a taste. We get a taste. Everybody gets happy.
no, also, but Amazon.com is an easy thing because everybody
right.
shops at Amazon.
But also
anyway.
you can get, you know, you can donate money directly to us with your donate button. Now, here's what I advise, that you get really, really drunk, that kind of drunk where you're really gregarious and in love with the world and you want to help everybody. Get that drunk before you get to the donate button and then get your
right.
credit card
think,
out
like, what is
and give
this
us
really
like $10,000. You think you start crying. You're like, all the times that Hannes and Christine have touched me or made me laugh or made me really
Do you
understand
know who
myself.
I've learned recently some of our biggest fans are, and I kid you not, are mail carriers.
Interesting.
I've gotten three emails from mail carriers just last week. Yeah, and I think that's pretty cool. Also, long distance truck drivers. So, although I think they're fans of almost every show.
yeah, I don't know. I don't know. What would you have to be putting out for a guy driving 45 hours straight to go, I can't listen to this? I can't.
Folks, follow us on Twitter at StoryWorthy. And wherever you are, stay tuned because Wally Rudolph is on his way here. On Storyworthy, we have director Bryn Hill.
And I'll be talking about a Hollywood kidnapping.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hey, everybody, it's the Scream Queen, Alina Madison, and you're listening to Storyworthy. Come on, you knew I was going to do that.
And
we're back. Oh, we drank entirely too much Leinenkugel. So now we've retired to Sally's Grill in Glendale, Wisconsin, the home of the butter burger.
Oh, my gosh.
Because nothing absorbs the alcohol in your system like a hamburger covered in grade A salted butter.
Is that true? They just put butter in a pan and then they put the meat in?
Don't be ridiculous. You fry the hamburger like a normal American.
Okay.
And then the hamburger's on a paper plate. That's very important. An old woman in a hairnet takes at least as much butter as there is burger, if not more, puts it on top of the burger, puts the top on the burger, and then hands it to you. And the butter melts down around the burger and leaves a ring on the paper plate.
Oh, my gosh. So you know it's good because of the ring.
Without the ring, it's not a real butter burger.
That's, I see.
That's what I'm saying.
How much does it cost anyway? How much does the butter burger cost?
Your life?
Clogged arteries?
It is oddly enough, they actually had to move, Sally's had to move from its original location about a block because they built the Milwaukee Cardiac Hospital.
That's not true.
It's completely true.
They happened
to build the cardiac hospital and they had to expand it and tore down the butter burger and moved it a block.
That's very
so funny. Now all the doctors who do nothing but, you know, the doctors, by the way, I'm sure still smoke after heart surgery in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. You think so? No.
Nah, probably not.
Yeah, everybody knows now.
I don't know.
I mean, the gig is up with smoking. I mean, a lot of people do smoke because they're addicted, and it's not just as easy as saying stop, obviously.
Yeah.
But it seems to me less people are starting.
Well, that's certainly true.
With.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is it was a social convention.
Right.
It was like, that's what you do. And it's like, that's now it's you don't. That's what you don't do. Kids today,
Let
me tell you this, like your nephew and all those young punks, everybody in their 20s, I see them smoking. I work with people who are 19, 20 years old. They smoke all the time.
Yeah. Parliament,
it's like it's
right?
gone completely backwards.
Isn't Parliament like the Hollywood cigarette?
That I don't know. Parliament.
They're green and white. The pack is green and white.
Do they still make that? Why don't
yeah,
really? Are they drinking Rob Roy's too?
Anyway,
by the way,
my nephew's like in his 30s now.
Oh, okay.
We always refer to him as a kid because we think that only...
He'll be 40 and right. I'll be like, you know, he'll be like, yeah, I got to go and have my, I got to have my spleen worked on. I'll be like, you young punks with your spleen, your hip spleen surgery.
All right,
the kids are getting the spleen surgery now.
We're in for a real treat. Wally Rudolph is here. And you know, Hannes, Wally is a writer and an actor. And his fiction has been published in Milk Money, Lines and Stars, The Brooklyner, and many other publications.
Brooklyner?
Yes. And as an actor, he's appeared in numerous films and TV shows, including Street Kings, Bang Bang, and Sons of Anarchy.
Sons of Anarchy. Of course, our friend Kurt.
Kurt Jaeger is on that show as well. Anyway, but Wally has a debut novel out right now called Four Corners, and it's published by Soft Skull Press. And let me just tell you this review of Four Corners. Wally Rudolph's meth and cocaine-addled protagonists reel through a nonstop catastrophe of violence, flight, and revenge, too self-destructive to have anything more than a prayer. But they are real. The action is urgent and compelling. The details are as crisp as the light that falls on Santa Fe. Wally knows the territory, and the territory is the human heart. So it's pretty interesting, and boy, it really does.
No, that sounds awesome. It sounds like a possible television project to me. I don't know. I think this could turn into something.
You can find him at WallyRudolph.com and also on Twitter at Wally Rudolph. So folks, wherever
you are,
put your hands together for Wally Rudolph.
This is how you see stars. By the time I knocked on Andre's door, Holt and Johnny Walker Red were sitting heavy on my eyelids like the man upstairs was doing all he could to put me down, tuck me in, help me call it a night. It was 8 p.m. I was at Andre's because he'd been bragging all week. He couldn't keep his mouth shut about a box of acid tabs that were landing that very night. He was from San Diego, never wore a shirt, and always sounded like he'd just woken up, smoked a pack of Old Golds, and gotten punched in the throat. Didn't matter the order. He was a West Coast surf bum that took to the high New Mexico desert faster than any of us. He was a natural. No, he was just natural. I'm from Dallas, Texas, and to this day I only know the hard way. Andre kept saying he was getting the hard shit, the mean shit, the family tree shit, and monkey nut doses on silver dollar mint tabs. He wasn't lying. I don't remember when he did it. Andre was good like that. He never made you ask. But all of a sudden, I was on my way out his door, whipped to the hilt on Kind Bud with one of the mint tabs of acid in my mouth like a melting dinner plate. I'd never seen such shit. Back home, my first dealer, the chubby Jesus, and his big brother, Rich, always sold me acid cut with strychnine, rat poison. Gotta play to play, man, they'd say. I never took the shit to be tested to uncover the secret of NIM. But I can tell you, it didn't matter if Beavis and Butthead, Superman, Daffy Duck, Felix the Cat, or just plain white was on that tiny blotter paper they sold me. Every single time I copped acid from the chubby Jesus, my back and neck turned into a short, rusted chain yanking at the back of my eyeballs. My flesh bloated to doughy clay, and when I sat still, I could barely control the itch to carve out my teeth with the business side of a hammer. Let me tell you, Andre shit did not do that. 10 minutes later, the family tree hit me hard and clean. I put on a sun skirt as soon as I got to my girl's place and told her I loved her 5 times before I closed the door. How you doing, Wally? She asked me. Ha! Ha! How am I doing? How am I doing? My pupils were black holes, stellar remnants and galactic nuclei dripped from a sombrero galaxy that was parked next to a rainbow lamp on the floor. I was only screaming for 5 minutes at the top of my lungs before my girl jammed a horse pill quaalude down my throat, patted me on the shoulder, and shoved me back out the door. King K, Johnny Walker Ruby Red, the familial tree, and now a thumb-sized quaalude. Same old Saturday night. By all accounts, I looked as close as a person can to being on fire without any flames. For 50 yards, I sprinted, still screaming, with my arms flailing like 2 giant buckwheat noodles. My head spasmed back and forth on my neck like a crash dummy, damned to live in his favorite wreck. My tongue rolled in and out of my mouth, stiff and then dead, stiff and then thick, limp and dead on my cheek. After 50 yards, I dropped in a patch of grass, my back arching up and down like a puppy readying an elephant shit. Then I sprawled, pancaked my chest to the dirt before I rose up like a voodoo ragdoll, my torso and neck folded at my waist parallel to the ground. I can't see straight, I screamed. I have to walk like this to see straight. I crossed a field back to a parking lot where just 4 hours earlier I'd been drinking all morning with my boys Alex and Ben. A crowd was gathered, a giant pink, brown, and black scat of faces smoking, drinking, and laughing. I limped towards them, Quasimodo in a sunskirt. Sanctuary? People nervously raised their hands. I watched their mouths open and close as they said hi, but all I heard was a deafening roar. A vacuum cleaner had been left on right behind me. It was on my heels on every step. Over and over, I shot around, trying to catch it, doing my own tripping crazy Ivan, trying to get a glimpse. But every time it saw me coming, I heard its plastic wheels skating on the cement as it rolled out of sight. Its plastic headlamp, like a mouse with a flashlight, scurried away. A tall redhead caught my eye. She was standing with her man on a stoop under a concrete awning. Her skin was bleached white and her lips were bright red. She was laughing, smoking on a skinny 110 menthol that hit my nose like an Ajax Vicks. Her man was standing behind her. He was taller than me, a solid 6 feet. He had his arms pretzeled over her shoulders, wrapped around her neck to keep them both warm. They were cold and in love. Say, bitch, I called at them. The words drawled out drunk and possessed. Say, bitch, say, bitch, I barked in a garble. The redhead's boyfriend looked at me, puzzled by the sight of this young brown Quasimodo in a skirt yelling, coaxing a fight. Say, bitch, say, bitch. Now it was just one word. In another setting, it could be passed off as an Armenian dessert or a Japanese breakfast soup. Say, bitch, say, bitch. The boyfriend cocked his head to the side and stood up, accepting my invitation to brawl. His girlfriend, the redhead, held him on the shoulder, but all it took was one mouth-watering spray of shabish to get her to let go and nod her head approvingly as if to say, yes, baby, please go break this sucker off. The boyfriend walked over. His baseball hat was pulled down low. To me, he was a tall black goose with a black beak and no eyes. Hey, yo, you need to shut the fuck up, said the goose. Say, bish? I asked back. Come on, man, I don't know you. Shut the fuck up and push on. Say, bish, I said, drawing it out to express my indifference to his olive branch. His long neck popped up and down. I'd ruffled him. He turned to his girlfriend, who had turned into Ronald McDonald on the stoop. Bish, say, bish, I said again, and took a wide step back and lowered my bent head even closer to the ground. The goose shook his head. Frustrated spittle shot from his beak before he puffed up and pushed me on the chest with his wings. But Quasimodo is low and strong. I didn't budge. I smiled, raised my fists, happy he'd accepted my brawl. Say bish, I said, nodding my head approvingly. The goose shrugged his shoulders, brought his feathers into black fists, and mumbled something I couldn't hear over the vacuum. That fucking vacuum, I thought as I jumped forward and threw my first blizzard of punches. Probably canister. I threw my fists in combinations that made sense to me in my head. A deadly unorthodox fighting style that I was reinventing after every punch. Right hook, left jab, twist, kneel, scratch the ground, spin, hop, and slam. Magic dust, spit. I danced in circles laughing. Say bish, rattling from my tongue. I was killing that old goose. Ronald McDonald watched, helpless from her castle. I pointed at the clown, warning her she was next. Say bish! But she wasn't. I was. If it wasn't for the love gangster Chad Larson, I'd be probably chewing with porcelain today. When I blacked out, he jumped in and only allowed a couple punches to bounce my head off the concrete. Respect. The next day, while I examined the long gash running down the bridge of my nose, Chad told me I was mumbling, drooling, spinning in a circle while I threw wild haymakers and spat nasties at anyone and everyone who was close. Real nasty. About people's mothers, their sister, everyone's unborn babies. This continued for a few minutes before the redhead's boyfriend stepped in and flattened me with four well-placed punches. People cheered, said Chad. To be honest, he did you a favor. Plenty of people wanted you dead. It was like a clinic. A very short boxing clinic.
Wow. Wow. Wally.
Okay. By the way, this is how we're going to keep your daughter from drinking. When she's 14, you're going to play this at her 14th birthday party.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, Alabama, do you want to chew porcelain?
Yeah.
Wait, is that chew a prison term?
No, I think it means having your teeth knocked out and having to have porcelain dentures.
What does it mean, Wally?
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, the porcelain dentures.
Okay,
yeah.
I was thinking something about, like, if you keep this up, you're going to prison.
Oh, I was going to get my
your head in the toilet?
Put into a toilet?
That's what I thought you were talking about.
No.
Okay, yeah, pull that closer to you if you'd like. Have you ever been to prison?
I spent some nights in jail, but no, I've not been in prison.
How many fights have you been in?
Quite a few.
Tell us about your upbringing.
I mean, it's a long story. I'll try to make it short. I mean, I was born in Canada. My family's from Jamaica. I was raised in Texas. So I grew up in Texas.
I was going to say
vast.
Canadians tend to not be that violent, but Texas, that makes
exactly,
more sense.
Exactly. It makes up for it. It balances it all out.
So
the passive nature.
You went to elementary school and high school in Texas?
Yeah, and then I went to college in New Mexico, and then I was in Chicago before I came out here to.
But you got to avoid the accent. That was good.
I think, Canadians are infamous for having kind of the moot or neutral accent. And I think if you get me back home, my Texas accent comes back.
Is that
for
right?
Better or for worse, yeah.
I think that happens everybody. My Milwaukee accent comes
everybody
back.
Everybody has that.
So what state were you in when you were having so much, all those problems with alcohol and drugs? Because the title of the story is Drunken Master, but you were on acid that night.
Yeah, I was on quite a bit that night.
I mean, Chubby Jesus did the job.
Chubby Jesus is back from Dallas. Chubby Jesus he was one of my first drug dealers back in Dallas. No, this is from New Mexico. This was when I was in college. This was my freshman year. I went to a school called the College of Santa Fe. It's no longer together. I believe they renamed it, but it was.
Did you set fire
school.
To the College of Santa Fe in an acid fueled?
I did on a separate occasion. I did set some fires.
Is that true? Is that true?
Did you set some
fires?
Yeah, I did a lot of things.
Did
back
you
at the college.
Setting fires? Was it like from an arsonist standpoint? Like
I think it was. I think it was the. I think it was from the I don't give a fuck standpoint.
But were you always drunk or high at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was the 90s. Nihilism was running rampant in the 90s. I think there was a lot of disgruntled youth. And from my generation.
I think
generation,
also that kind of behavior usually is like, look at me, notice me. People, set themselves on fire. But, hey, you're a different kind of cat.
Yeah, so, I when you're young, I think there was, that was, I hate that word zeitgeist, but that was, you know, the 90s were really like that, the with the youth, and that was kind of the vibe. It was like the 70s were raging, came back, or the 60s came back raging, angry. They had the Woodstock thing where, the you know, they tried to redo Woodstock, but it turned into a complete riot.
But this is interesting. You're talking about, you know, in the 90s, you were in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Because when I hear Santa Fe, I think of turquoise, beating rugs,
New age music, massages.
Yeah, oh, there's all that.
But
yeah.
But I've also been to Santa Fe, and I know there's a tremendous amount of poverty.
Yes, that is the I think that's the rub of New Mexico across the board. I think it's a frustrating part of New Mexico because it's absolutely gorgeous. I say in the book that it's God's country, and I really believe that. I mean, the Southwest, New Mexico, that high desert mountain region.
No, I remember when I moved to Los Angeles and we drove through, and it was nighttime, and we drove through Mexico, and you literally feel like you're on another planet. It's like, this is not the Earth. This is so gorgeous, it can't be a real place. Can I just ask a question about your writing style? Yeah. Two writers you reminded me of in your style, Hunter S. Thompson and William S. Burroughs.
Well, Hunter S. Thompson, definitely. Maybe it's just my glasses today.
No. But the very detail, taking your drug experience and describing it in what is like incredibly detailed literary language, so that me, who has never done acid, can understand exactly what's going on, which is a very hard thing to translate something that's completely nonverbal into something verbal. And that's something that both those guys did. So yeah, Burroughs, did you read him or no?
Yeah, I've read my fair share of both of them. Yeah, being compared to them always. So
Hunter S. Thompson would be closer. Well, he's obviously closer in, I mean, he's generationally, he's closer to your generation. You feel more of a connection with him?
I think if I feel connection as far as contemporary writers, it would be Dennis Johnson, of course. He's a big, he wrote Tree of Smoke, Jesus' Son, that film that came out several, it was kind of one of Billy Crudup's first films. He's an incredible.
What's his name again? Tell me.
Dennis Johnson with one N. A lot of course, Hunter S. Thompson, but I wouldn't say I'm.
You're not consciously.
Not remotely. To be honest, if anything, I read a fair amount of more poetry than I do fiction.
Is that right? Because, yeah, you know, I'm just listening to that story. And I would expect that your book, Four Corners, is in the tone of the story you just read. Is that true?
Yes. I think there's a humor. I think this humor isn't as prevalent as it was in the piece that I just read right now. But it's – I mean, that's – you know, I write the way I write.
Because Four Corners is about – it's a crime novel.
Yeah, it's a crime novel among other things. You know, it's a Bonnie and Clyde story for a new generation almost.
Yeah, you really get down and dirty in like scraping the crud off of the floor when just the story you just told. I mean, it's really harsh words and language, and it seems like you're so at peace now that you ever were in that place.
You know, I think.
Or are you heightening the experience?
No, no, not at all. I really don't. I mean, a little bit in this piece, in the sense that, you know, to try to get a laugh or two or whatever, in that sense. But I think, you know, the goal of my work, whether it's I'm talking about poverty, if I'm trying to paint a really realistic portrait of poverty, or drug addiction, which is really prevalent in Four Corners, or love, or that deep, you know, rampant kind of lustful kind of love and sex, which is really inside Four Corners, is that, you know, I'm trying to do it in the most unsentimental way, but trying to do it with compassion. And I think within that, I'm trying to make it the biggest compliment, or what I want people to feel when they read my work, is that it's real, and that people who've done drugs, or
listen,
people who've got it, they can touch it and say, that's pretty close.
Wally, you're sitting 2 feet from me, and you just scared the shit out of me with that say bitch monologue.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said it back then.
That's scary, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's also good acting. I mean, this may sound silly, but it's like, you know, many people can write, but they can't perform it. You actually have the ability to do both, because it's very possible that somebody could write something exactly as compelling as that, and then they're reading it to you in Skylight
Stephen
Books.
Stephen King's
in,
book.
You know, and it's like, and then I said, say bitch. Yeah.
Stephen
say
King
bitch,
is a good
I said.
He doesn't, he's not very fun to listen to.
He doesn't put an inflection on
he's
anything.
Not. He's not an actor. You're an actor and a writer.
Yeah, that's terrific. So, Wally, how long have you been clean?
It's going to be 7 years now, 7 years.
And that's clean and sober and everything.
I'm really clean and sober because I quit smoking about a month ago or 2 months ago.
Congratulations.
Now.
Good.
Yeah. I didn't come to my sobriety through AA or NA. I really love those programs. I think they're so important. I came to it kind of through, 6.5-7 years of hardcore therapy, and I kind of got there. So it wasn't that much of like an AA where I got a chip. It was literally one day I woke up and I was barely drinking, and an old friend came into town and I had a drink, and I woke up and I ended up having a migraine for like 2 weeks. And I was like, that's it for me. Yeah, it was really scary.
Was that your first migraine?
Yeah, and How did you
identify it as a migraine?
After I went to several doctors, because I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. And they're like, this is what a migraine, clustered bomb headache, whatever.
Cluster headaches.
Yeah. And they were like, this is what they are. And I was just like, this is insane. And I was like, you know what? That's done. Like, I'm done. I'm not even going to touch.
Amazing.
See,
I'm
that's
so happy
yeah,
for
that's
you.
That's yeah.
terrific. You and
that's
you
what
the
we need is more. See, if we could just induce migraines in more alcoholics,
but I think to come to that kind of moment of clarity is so brilliant because you know you made the choice. You weren't connived.
Well, I was not. I was kind of. I think I was pretty much. You know,
it ran its course.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes people have outside. You know, you have a car accident or something. It's like it's forced upon you, and you just. Well, luckily for you, you never. You could easily have had car accidents. You could easily have hurt people. So it's like, luckily for you, you came to the point where you're like, you know what? I'm hurting myself.
Yeah,
I'm literally hurting myself. I can't stand up.
Unfortunately, I planned plenty of car accidents.
Yeah, how many people did you hurt, Wally?
In my grand total, I hurt a lot of people. I think whether it be physically or emotionally, I tore up a couple of cars, and I think bottoming out was what. Took me to therapy. What it would be like 2002 or 2003 bottomed me out in that sense. Took me to therapy and kind of eventually got me sober.
Did you ever use weapons?
Not guns and knives. I've owned brass knuckles and carried rolls of pennies.
Wait a minute. Explain the rolls of pennies.
Mexican.
Oh, you're such a girl. You put
roll
of pennies.
No, I know, but I want to hear it from the criminal.
Right,
you're making me.
I'm not a crip. Small time. It's just small time guy.
That's our new slogan. Hear it from the criminal. Story worthy.
It makes your fist a little bit harder when you're punching and stuff. That being said, I've gotten my ass kicked plenty of times, and this one story is one story of many where I've gotten my
your language, you know, your character descriptions, you know, a puffed up goose, and then you're a Quasimodo. It's so clear to listen to your story. Oh, wow. You know, it really paints a picture.
Thank you.
When did you start writing, Wally?
I started writing when I was little.
I was,
fifth or sixth grade.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I started, like, having an interest in it. I started acting in seventh grade. And I kind of did them both for a really long time. I studied them both in college. I think I was conscious enough. My acting career kind of took precedence over it just because it was paid better, and it's professionally I was maturing a lot quicker. The book, when I started writing professionally, I kind of just hit a place where I realized that I had something to say and I was comfortable with what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it. Everything kind of was starting to really come together. And I had kind of been waiting for it. I wrote a lot for the stage. I wrote a lot. I wrote a lot of short fiction.
Did you write screenplays?
I've taken a hand at screenplays. I've written one. One's been optioned. This is years ago now. This is one. But to be honest, I mean, I think when I finally completed Four Corners, I finally everything made sense to me as far as that's the medium that what it's all said and done. I you know, acting is my job. It's my day job. I take it.
But fiction is where you are.
Yeah, novel writing is really where I finally felt challenged enough, and the medium made sense to me. I assume it's what a painter would feel when he picked up the paint. Where I was just like, yeah, this is really what I want to do.
It's so exciting, and it must come through in your work, because your book Four Corners, which was, let's see, it's published by Soft Skull Press, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Soft Skull Press.
And it's for sale right now, and it's
yes.
doing very well.
Yes.
So, you know, it's almost summertime, and people go out, they pick up a book, they go to the pool.
Yes.
This is the book to pick up, Four
this
Corners.
Is a, yes, this is the book to pick up. It's good to go, it's good to read it in the winter. It's good to read it, when you wake up in the middle
it's
of the night.
It's a seasonal book.
It's all seasonal.
I don't think in the middle of the night, I'm going to say no for me on that. No. Maybe when I, you know, it's like I'm on a long road trip and I'm like, I really need to feel good about my choices. I'm going to read.
Yeah. It's an exciting book. It'll
and make you've got to write this character out, you know, and call it Say Bitch. And let's get this thing produced, because I can see so many different actors playing this character.
Yeah.
You being the first.
Yeah. Hopefully you want to Sylvester Stallone it and be able to be in it yourself. That would be
the idea, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Let's try it out.
It can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Growing up. Man, I got a lot of those. I guess growing up, I can say the first time I kissed a girl was when, this is a good one. I lived in a suburb of Dallas called Richardson, Texas. And it was a nice little suburb. We lived across the street from one of the only natural creeks in Dallas, Prairie Creek. And I used to sneak out of my house at night when I was in junior high and go running through the creek. It was a really great time. It was really like innocent, crazy, dangerous fun, just running through the creek and riding my bike all around through there. And I used to go and sneak a girl used to sneak out of her house, and we used to go and sit on this bridge at night. And I was like a pipsqueak, and I was so uncomfortable around girls back then. It would drive me – thinking about it. My palms would get sweaty, and we'd sit on this bridge. And I remember the first – she wanted me to kiss her so badly, but I was so terrified, and I completely – miffed it. I 100% miffed it. She leaned in, and I think I started coughing uncontrollably. It was pretty pathetic. So that was my first kiss.
Yeah. Oh, that's an adorable story.
Yeah.
Do you know, Wally, kids don't really ride bikes anymore. Did you know that?
Is that the truth?
My daughter is 7, does not know how to ride a bike.
My boy loves scooters.
And oh, yeah. My daughter's on a scooter. Exactly.
Yeah, scooters. Yeah. I think it's a different thing out here in Los Angeles. I've realized that because there's just so much traffic.
Well, you can't just let your kid go out of the house on their bike.
I never wore a helmet in my life, and I've got my child in a helmet and doubled up in two sweaters and, like, don't get hit. But
you're duct taping bubble wrap around them.
Yeah.
My daughter can ride the bike with training wheels, and now we took the training wheels off, and so now she can kind of ride it as if it's a balance bike. But I don't even know if I should go to the next level, you know, to get the bigger girl bike, you know, with the sissy bars or whatever. I don't know if I should.
Why are you holding on? You don't hold out on her. You got to check.
Yeah, but you're right. It's LA. I mean, where is she going to ride?
There's nowhere to ride. I'd have to take the bike to the park or take it to the beach. I understand. I could do that. I should do that, for God's sake.
You really have to do that. Jeez. Come on.
I live near the ocean. I don't take my kid to the beach. What kind of mother
you
am
know,
I?
You know, we don't live that near to the ocean. We live
Say
near enough.
Bitch.
Yeah, yes. Bitch. No, it's like, you know, people think – it's like we don't – you know, the kids – people listening in Washington, D.C., our major market. It's like we don't live near the ocean. It's near enough to get to, but it's a pain in the ass. And
well,
we don't go as often as you think
away,
we are.
To be fair.
How often do you actually go to the beach?
Twice a year.
Twice a year. No.
I go to the beach about 6 times a year.
You go more than anyone I've ever met, and that's still once every 2 months.
Because I love Malibu and I love
Sumo. You would think you would go.
Going to Malibu is different than just going to the beach.
I know, right?
It's a whole other.
Yeah, Malibu's no joke.
No joke at all.
When we go to the beach, we just go down to the pier.
Yeah, down
to Malibu's fancy, man. It's fancy.
Oh, no, but here's what Malibu has. It's like El Matador State Beach, which is just, that big rocky beach.
Yeah.
Malibu has some lovely shoreline. And also, like Zuma, it's just a big old beach and a whole lot of ocean. You know, there's no houses in Zuma. It's just...
No one can see anything you're doing up there.
Nope, that's what I'm saying.
There's no one to watch. There's no witnesses.
That's what I'm saying. So
except Google Maps. They're always photographing you from above.
Wally Rudolph, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Just wonderful. And Four Corners is available right now. And anywhere you look, you're going to find the book Four Corners.
I suggest you buy it from Amazon. Going through our website, storywithapodcast.com.
See how he's always thinking, isn't he, Anthony?
Oh, it's Anthony. You see, we've woken him up now.
All right,
corners,
you guys.
Baby.
We're going to wrap it up right about now. Thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Anthony Bench and, of course, Sean Merrick. And on behalf of our storyteller tonight, Wally Rudolph, and, of course, John Thomas Griffith. You know, he's the guy that wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
Never heard of him. I think I was in a bar fight with him once, but
and
I can't remember.
And on behalf of you, Honest Vinny, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.